This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, October 26th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On Wednesday, Senator Flake of Arizona announced that he would not be seeking re-election in 2018. Unlike almost all of his colleagues, Flake has been a persistent critic of Trump. In his speech on the Senate floor, he delivered a blistering condemnation of Trump and a rebuke to GOP leadership.
If we simply become inured to this condition, thinking that it is just politics as usual, then heaven help us. Without fear of the consequences and without consideration of the rules of what is politically safe or palatable, we must stop pretending that the degradation of our politics and the conduct of some in our executive branch are normal. They are not normal. Reckless, outrageous, and undignified behavior has become excused and countenanced as telling it like it is, when it is actually just reckless, outrageous, and undignified. And when such behavior emanates from the top of our government, it is something else. It is dangerous to a democracy. Such behavior does not project strength, because our strength comes from our values. It instead projects a corruption of the spirit and weakness. It is often said that children are watching. Well, they are. And what are we going to do about that? When the next generation asks us, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you speak up? What are we going to say? Mr. President, I rise today to say enough.
Ryan Lizza joins me to discuss whether the Republican Party is becoming the Trump Party and what traditional Republicans can do to check the president's destruction of fundamental American principles. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good.
Let's start by talking about Senator Flake, who has served in Congress since 2000, but this is only his first term as senator. You know, back when he was elected, he was seen by both parties as a standard bearer of conservatism. He recently published that book attacking Trumpism, essentially, and all the forces that the party seems to be succumbing to now. So he's a good way of looking at how the party got to the point where we are now, where he couldn't win a Republican primary.
He couldn't win a Republican primary. And as you point out, he was considered really on the far right, the heir to Barry Goldwater conservatism. And when he was a member of the House, was part of a younger generation of bomb throwers. So, you know, it's sort of remarkable that he's ending his career in Congress as the voice of the establishment and more traditional conservatism. And I thought the really interesting thing about both his speech and then the interviews he did afterwards was how little it had to do with ideology. What he basically said is he couldn't win the primary unless he pandered to Trump himself. And he pointed out that it wasn't so much that he has a difference of opinion with Trump on immigration or whatever issues they differ on, but that Republican voters see criticism of Trump himself as a heresy. And that's the thing that was so astounding to him, is that Trump himself is what is defining the Republican Party right now. And that view is definitely backed up by the polling. You see some of the polls this week that showed Trump with above 80% support among Republican voters. One interesting question in a CNN poll showed that, when people are asked, do you like the Republican Party more or do you like Donald Trump more? People like Donald Trump. So he really has a bond with the base of the party that people like Flake can't break.
So we're in a situation where the only Republicans who consistently go after Trump are the ones who won't be running again for office.
Yes. And so I think we don't know the end of the story here. I think the one big question about this dynamic with all of these moderates, it's funny to call some of these guys moderates because they're really not. I think the question that will be answered over the next few election cycles is whether Trump is a leading indicator or a lagging indicator in the Republican Party. Will these guys be replaced by more Trump-like candidates, or will they be replaced by Democrats because there's a sort of backlash against where the Republican Party is going?
So let's look at Lindsey Graham, who not so long ago was calling Trump a jackass and an idiot.
Yeah.
And he was praised for it quietly by his colleagues. Now it seems he just wants to get tax cuts passed, even if they bust the budget. And he used to be a deficit hawk. So where is his conscience?
He's a great example. And he's so closely associated with John McCain. And we obviously know how McCain feels about Trump. So it is interesting that Graham has been very strategic recently in wooing Trump. They famously have played golf a couple of times. He hasn't backed away from his criticism on certain issues, especially Russia, but he has sort of accepted that Trump is the president. He's a Republican president, and they can do business together. Flake and Corker are in a different place in terms of that. But I think this gets at the second, you know, sort of powerful dynamic that is keeping Trump buoyant within the Republican Party. The first is just the fact that the grassroots of the party likes him and supports him. There's just no doubt about that. And that makes a lot of members of Congress scared to cross him. But then the second dynamic is just that Republicans have unified control of Washington, and they are willing to overlook an enormous amount of unusual behavior in order to have a president who will sign into law their pre-Trump agenda.
But it's not as though he's helping them get their agenda passed.
Well,
he's hurting it in most cases.
Exactly. They haven't done anything this year, right? I think you have to view the tax reform effort right now as a sort of 50-50 proposition.
And yet it has to be passed by the end of the year?
It doesn't have to be passed by the end of the year. That's their sort of ambition, but it could easily spill into next year.
But there's a big symbolic thing at issue here. At the end of the year, if that means he's gone through the whole first year of his presidency essentially accomplishing nothing.
Yeah, and just as a side note, since we're on this topic, this is something I've been sort of keeping an eye on. The only thing that has to pass by the end of the year are the annual appropriations bills, which a lot of Republicans will never vote for them because they think the spending is too high. And so Trump will have to have Democrats to keep the government open. And those Democratic votes will come at some cost. And so you could have a situation where we go into the new year where the only thing that actually gets accomplished is some deal between Trump and Schumer and Pelosi where the Democrats actually get a serious legislative
victory. Well, that's going to play well with the base.
And under that scenario, tax reform may or may not still be alive, you know, because tax reform can be kicked into next year. But that's something to keep an eye on, and that would obviously infuriate a lot of Republicans.
And again, I think as we discussed the last time you were on this program, it's not really tax reform, it's tax cuts, and it's tax cuts for the super wealthy.
It's just completely backwards, because what they care about are the rate cuts, and they have been had a really tough time in figuring out how to pay for it because, you know, every tax deduction that gets you a lot of revenue is popular with some important group. And on Thursday, the House of Representatives passed the budget, but Paul Ryan lost 20 Republicans because they don't like this proposal that's still on the table to get rid of the state and local tax deduction. A lot of Republicans from high tax states like New York and California want to keep that. It's very important to their constituents. Every time they've come up with something to pay for the rate cuts, it gets shot down by some important constituency. And that's why I think a lot of smart people think that in the end of the day, those rate cuts are not going to be paid for, and it'll just be a big tax cut that explodes the deficit. And then there'll be some Republicans in the Senate who will have to decide if they're okay, you know, if they're willing to go along with that or not.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Let's go back to the quotation of Flake's from his speech that we were just listening to, where he talks about the reckless, outrageous, and undignified behavior of the president and how it's dangerous to a democracy. So I was on a panel recently at the New Yorker Festival, and one of the guests was the Republican consultant Rick Wilson. And he said, you know, that these members are just petrified of Trump's tweets because of what happens. They get bombarded with hate mails. They get attacked by Breitbart. There are conspiracy theories about them and their family. And they just, he says, don't want the friction of it.
And this is what Bob Corker said recently. He said the majority of Republican senators have the same view of Trump as he has. They just don't want to talk about it. And I think there are two key questions. One is, what is the red line for a Republican member, you know, where they go where Flake has gone? And then the other question to me is, once you've gone there, what do you actually do, right? So what is Jeff Flake and Bob Corker and John McCain, how do they actually act on this belief that Trump is unfit to be president and is a national security threat?
What do you think the red line is?
For Corker, it was North Korea. He's the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and he was, you know, freaked out about the way that Trump was dealing with this through Twitter. And I think that was the red line for him. And he decided, you know, a tax cut on Neil Gorsuch isn't worth a third world war. And I reached out to some of the usual never Trump voices asking, you know, what now? What do you do? What do the Flake Republicans do to constrain Trump? And there were a number of ideas from some smart conservatives, but they all were in the realm of making Congress a co-equal branch of government, standing up to Trump, using oversight authority, basically turning Congress into a more of an oppositional force to Trump, kind of like the way you would if the president were a member of the opposite party. Now, one of the things about the presidency right now is Trump inherited a very powerful presidency, right? There was a major expansion of the authority of the president from 9/11 on. And then in the Obama years, frankly, Obama, once he got frustrated with Congress, was extremely creative about expanding the powers of the White House through executive orders and other things. Now, Trump has inherited all of that, and one way to start reining him in would be to rein those expansions in. But that's not where most Republicans are. Most Republicans are, we want to repeal Obamacare, pass tax cuts, and, you know, the rest of the agenda. I thought Flake's speech, another thing I found interesting was it was indeed an attack on Trump, but his main target was other Republicans. He was basically saying, it's time for you to speak up because otherwise you're complicit.
But what is he then asking his fellow Republicans to do specifically?
I think the first thing, there was one other Republican I talked to who didn't want to be quoted on the record about this, but he did say that just speaking out is essential. Because Trump is essentially, in his view, gaslighting the American people and constantly putting out a stream of BS and untruths, that one of the most important things that Republicans can do is simply speak out when he is lying and just be a constant reminder that when he is lying and just pointing it out. I think that Flake was saying that's the starting point, is just speak up.
And I guess that would answer the question of whether the Bannon wing is winning and whether the Republican Party is becoming the party of Trump.
It's hard not to make the case that the Bannon wing, it's hard to make the case that they're losing. I mean, Flake had to retire because he couldn't win re-election. Corker had to retire basically for the same reason. Now, maybe the Bannon candidates won't win those seats, but I think the real challenge for guys like Flake and Corker is they have to go to the Republican voters and make the case for what is problematic about Trump, right? A lot of times they're preaching to the choir about Trump, but, you know, we live in a democracy. He has the support of 35-40% of the country, and these guys have to find a way to make the case to their own voters about what is so problematic about him.
And what is the Democrats' proper role in this time of crisis? It's interesting. There was another story this morning saying that Democrats are actually crushing Republicans in fundraising for 2018. So clearly, their base is coming out in big numbers and putting money on their candidates. What do you think we're going to be seeing in coming months as the two parties gear up for 2018?
Well, I would say even before that, pay attention to what happens in Virginia and New Jersey, where we have these off-year gubernatorial elections. New Jersey looks pretty solid for the Democrats, but Virginia is a state that's been trending for the Democrats for a while now, and I think most Democrats thought it was a lock to keep the governorship. The governor there is Democratic, is Terry McAuliffe. But the polls have suddenly tightened in the last couple of weeks. Ed Gillespie, a sort of George Bush-era establishment Republican who had a real scare from a more Trump-like candidate in the primary, has suddenly been embraced by Trump, who's tweeted about him several times on Thursday. And Gillespie has started to use crime and Confederate monuments as the issues of the campaign, something frankly kind of out of character for him if you look at his history, and is sort of not exactly embracing Trump, doesn't talk about him a whole lot because Trump is very unpopular in Northern Virginia, you know, the D.C. suburbs, but he is suddenly dancing with some of those issues, and it's frankly working. And I think if, despite the enthusiasm that Democrats have and the fundraising that you're talking about, if the Democrats lose that seat in Virginia to a candidate that Trump embraced and a candidate who used some of these cultural wedge issues that Trump uses, there are going to be a lot of Democrats who are wondering how they can actually win in the era of Trump. There are going to be a lot of Republicans who say, wow, Ed Gillespie won that seat by going in a Trump direction. That's probably what I have to do, too.
Okay. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Ryan Liss is a staff writer and an on-air contributor for CNN. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for newyorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.